Welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of our podcast. I want to thank all of our listeners for coming back to our podcast again and again and actually gathering the wisdom that resides in the words that these authors provide to us. And very special today, we have Alan Brishkin on, and it is The Power of Collective Wisdom and the Trap of Collective Folly. Very cool book for all of our listeners out there. Good day to you, Alan.
Hello, Greg. Good to be with you again.
Well, we appreciate having you on, and I want to tell our listeners just a little bit about you and your background. And actually, this is a co-authored book. Again, it's about collective wisdom. So Cheryl Erickson, correct? John Ott.
Correct.
And Tom, how do you pronounce his last name?
Callanan.
Callanan.
Yep.
And the foreword of this book is by Peter Senge. This is a wonderful book that you've put together, and it's such an opportune time in society. It's so needed. But Alan is an award-winning author, a pioneer in the field of organizational learning, and the co-founder of the Collective Wisdom Initiative. This newest book, co-authored with the three authors we just talked about, is The Power of Collective Wisdom, The Trap of Collective Folly. His other books include The Stirring of Soul in the Workplace and co-authored Bringing Your Soul to Work, An Everyday Practice and Daily Miracles. Alan's work as an organizational consultant and interest in groups and collective extends back to the early 70s when he was part of the international community in Israel. He's a founding member of the Relationship-Centered Care Network, which advises the marriage of compassion and clinical excellence in healthcare, and he's been doing that for nearly 10 years. He was also a consultant to George Lucas Educational Foundation. He's joining us from Berkeley today, and you know, I'd like to really start off, what for our listeners, really, what is collective wisdom?
In the most general way, Greg, collective wisdom refers to knowledge and insight gained through group and community interaction. But at a deeper level, it's about our living connection to each other and the interdependence we share in our neighborhoods, organizations, and world community. The words collective wisdom was really joining two words that might even be seen as opposites. The nature of the collective is an understanding that we're always part of something larger than just ourselves. But the collective itself can operate in ways that are not necessarily wise. Matter of fact, many people have the experience, if not the primary experience, of finding groups to be very suffocating, to find different collective activities very difficult to get things done. And so joining that concept of collective, that we are always part of something larger than ourselves, with wisdom, and that wisdom is the ability practice sound judgment, and it's also an element of wisdom is revelation, the ability to use intuition and our multiple kinds of intelligences to identify the best approach to the kinds of dilemmas and conflicts we experience.
Mm. So how is it that the three of you came together, or I should say, the four of you came together to actually write this book? Can you give us a little bit of history about that?
Yeah, I think the backstory is very relevant to the book's message. Tom Callanan was a program officer at a philanthropic organization in Michigan. They had been bringing people together in dialogue from all over the world. When we met, he had just come back from Dharamsala, where Fetzer had helped orchestrate a meeting with the Dalai Lama. And he was very interested about when groups achieved extraordinary results. As someone who had brought together many different groups, he knew that sometimes groups get together and people talk right through each other, or they are very agreeable, but nothing really of any interest gets done. Other times there's extraordinary moments. And he was colleagues with Cheryl Erickson. He asked her if she'd be the program director of a very small initiative initially to look at if we could find the groundwork behind what makes groups extraordinary. Cheryl and I were colleagues, and she asked me to be the senior editor and primary writer for that effort. And we began by interviewing, a network of us began interviewing dozens of people and had dozens of transcripts which we worked with.
So why is it
from that?
Go ahead.
And from that, and this is about 10 years ago, we came to believe that the interest in groups being a vehicle for transformation was growing exponentially across the globe. That everywhere we began to look, we began to see people bringing groups together for healing and creation, for problem solving, for innovation, for new ways of collaboration. This was not only in spiritual communities, but this was in the workplace as well. And that gave us the impetus to say to the foundation that we saw a social movement occurring, and this is about 10 years ago, and that we wanted to be able to make visible this social movement. And we started the Collective Wisdom Initiative at that time. John Ock was part of that initial effort. And the story that I think inspired the book, long before we actually knew a book was to be created, was a chance meeting at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, where we met the founder, Edgar Mitchell, who was an Apollo 14 astronaut. And we asked him if there was any relationship between his going to the moon and his founding of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And he, right on the spot, told us a story, he's told many times, of returning from the moon.
Yeah.
As he's returning to the moon, begins to have an experience of which there's no English word for. He said that the closest he's come such a word was the Indian word samadhi, the sense of interconnectedness, that we are, that there's not an us and them, but it's all us. And we were very moved by his explanation and his experience. There were tears in his eyes as he told us the story. And this was many years before the four of us came together to write the book, but I really see it as the inspirational seed that, that led to our thinking.
Wow, that's a very cool story. Now, a question for you. In today's world, you know, we have people moving at breakneck speed and utilizing the internet to go broad and deep. And it seems like the internet has become a great place for people to connect in group. I mean, everything from Facebook to Twitter. But yet there seems to be a breadth and no depth. What is it that needs to happen or can happen in your perspective to possibly use this technology to bring groups together and then to have those groups go to more of a deep level?
Well, technology is always an extension of human consciousness. So when we applaud technology or when we decry technology as ruining our life, we're really simply talking about the nature of our own consciousness and what kinds of reflection, what kinds of discipline we need to bring. Social technologies, like all technologies before it, is a human invention. And if we are frantic, if we are feeling fragmented, if we are trying to do more and more but harvest less and less wisdom, then one would have to say social technologies would follow that path. At the same time, there is an enormous number of social technologies that are emerging that are linking us together, that are allowing us to see each other's thoughts, that are allowing us to deepen our connection to each other. My colleagues, Juanita Brown and David Isaac, in developing the World Cafe, it was part of a very human social technology of getting people to sit around small tables and talk with each other and then move from table to table until the whole room was is buzzing with the conversations that are going on in the room. The same is true with more technological social technologies, the web, Twitter, all the different ways we have of connecting to each other. You know, if we have nothing to say and want to do that more often, you know, then as many people as you just referred, there's a feeling of superficiality to the interaction. But if we use social technologies creatively, and people are beginning to do this, then we have for the first time an ability to really link with each other. A hospital can send out a Zoomerang survey and ask about quality from all its frontline nurses. I was just with a senior person at Cisco, and they're developing ways that hundreds of people can be on a phone call and then break into small groups of five each talking more directly with each other before coming back on the main line. So we're at a very early part of our learning curve about how to use social technologies effectively. And as always, you know, wisdom is saying, don't look at what's happening in the moment. Look at what is the possibilities of the moment. Look at what we can create and invent with each other if we have the conscious, if technology is truly an extension of the consciousness of bringing people together.
Well, that's a very good point you make, and it puts it into perspective that this technology can be used for good, and that it can be used to actually take people to these levels of collective wisdom. Now, you have a chapter in the book. It says preparing for collective wisdom to arise, and actually, this chapter kind of outlines some of the things that need to happen, like deep listening and suspension of certainty and seeing whole systems, seeking diverse perspectives, respect for others, welcoming all that's arising. Can you explain, as collective wisdom is going to arise, what are the things that our listeners would need to do to actually prepare? What, put it in your words.
The first thing we wanted to do as authors is to create a certain useful dissonance for the reader by saying that collective wisdom is not a recipe. You know, you don't take two parts of this and one part of this and all of a sudden have sound judgment. So the first intention was to bring the reader's awareness that this is not just one more list of things to do. And to say it is possible for wisdom to arise, but the very consciousness that seeks it must be respectful of what's required for it to arise. So you can't force it, you can't demand it, you can't yell at a group and say, you know, in the next 10 minutes we better have collective wisdom or else half of you will be fired. It doesn't work like that. So what is it that we can do to prepare ourselves first and the group to cultivate the soil for this kind of deeper connection with each other? And the first stance, and we purposely didn't use principles as our language. We talked about stances, commitments and actions each of us can make. And we can make this regardless of how fragmented the systems that we're in. And so the first stance is deep listening. And it's an inversion of the idea of leadership always being about talking, or that in order to get a group to do what you want, you have to talk. Listening of this kind, and that's why we call it deep listening, is a way of hearing the emotional language behind the words, a way of listening to the aspirations that exist with others and with oneself. One of the people we talk about in the book is Paula Underwood, who is from the Turtle Clan of the Iroquois. And she describes deep listening for herself as she developed it as a young girl who learned to memorize everything that people were saying to her. And her father says, "I know, honey girl, that you know how to, you know what they are saying, what words they are using. Now can you listen to their heart?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very.
And with that, she's so taken by that she spends the next period of time crawling into people's laps and putting her ear to their chests.
Wow.
So she could listen to their hearts.
Wow. Well, I know there are things for people to prepare, and one of the things that we discussed a little bit about before you came on the line was a quote by David Bohm. Now, some of our listeners are going to know David Bohm, and I'm very familiar with his work and some aren't, but you were talking about that quote as it relates to the interconnectedness of all human beings. Can you discuss that for a minute and the connection that you made there?
Yeah, I was mentioning Bohm's quote and actually contrasting it with a part of a speech from Nelson Mandela. Bohm, of course, was the physicist who was exploring how what he was learning about the subatomic world related to human consciousness. Nelson Mandela, of course, was the leader of South Africa after apartheid. And let me read you the Bohm quote first and comment on it, and then compare it with how Nelson Mandela viewed his leadership. Bohm says, at present, people create barriers between each other by their fragmentary thought. Each one operates separately. When these barriers have dissolved, then there arises one mind where they are all one unit. But each person also retains his or her own individual awareness. So I'm going to comment that this extraordinary idea that one can become aware of being part of a group consciousness while still retaining one's own individual awareness. He goes on, that one mind will still exist even when they are separate, meaning the group mind, and when they come together, it will be as if they hadn't separated. It's actually a single intelligence that works with people who are moving in relationship with one another. If you had a number of people who really pulled together and worked together in this way, it would be remarkable. They would stand out so much that everyone would know they were different. So Bohm here is talking about a singular intelligence that can arise when people are working in concert with each other, when they are literally moving with each other. And the power of that and our ability personally to be empowered by knowing while we can't just simply stop the fragmented thought that is all around us, we can begin to heal it in ourselves and we can begin to join with others for things that are worthy. I say this as a transition to Nelson Mandela's comment that was in his speech when he finished when he was done with being president of South Africa, and he was thanking the nation for the transition they had been able to accomplish through apartheid. And he says, this is Nelson Mandela, to the extent that I've been able to achieve anything, I know that this is because I am the product of the people of South Africa. I am the product of the rural masses who inspired in me the pride in our past and the spirit of resistance. I am the product of the workers of South Africa who in the mines, factories, fields, and offices of our country have pursued the principle that the interests of each are founded in the common interest of all. I am the product of South Africa's intelligentsia of every color who have labored to give our society knowledge of itself to fashion our people's aspirations into a realizable dream. I am the product of South Africa's business people in industry, in agriculture, commerce, and finance, whose spirit of enterprise has helped turn our country's immense natural resources into the wealth of our nation. That was Nelson Mandela speaking, and I thought it was a complement to Bohm's concept of the singular intelligence of the group. Here's a person who so identified with the collective that they could feel that as a leader, they could give expression to that collective.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that. What a great way to articulate that. Thank you. I'm sure that the listeners and myself, especially when you were talking about David Bohm and then how you actually articulated Nelson Mandela's collective, him being come part of the collective of the people. What is interesting is in your title of your book, it's The Power of Collective Wisdom and the Trap of Collective Folly. Let me talk about this collective folly for a second. What makes – you have a chapter in here, What Makes Groups Foolish? What is this folly behavior and what actually do make these groups foolish, and can you comment on that?
Yeah, it was very important for us in talking about collective wisdom to not present it in isolation of how most people experience the world and to not suggest that somehow you could become collectively wise and never have to worry about folly or foolish behavior. And so it was critical that the book reflect that just as any group can move toward wisdom, any group can move toward folly. And that it is our mindfulness that we have in relation to others that allows us to navigate between wisdom and folly.
And what do you exactly mean by folly? I mean, you give a definition right up front in the book,
yes.
But let our listeners know what folly actually is.
How we define folly and then how we talk about collective folly. Folly in some ways was a surprise to us when we looked up the word in the dictionary, was lacking good sense or normal prudence and foresight. It's a continuum of behaviors ranging from personally foolish behavior to criminality, evil, and depravity. So folly, while we may know it in its benign form as just someone being foolish or silly, it can have the shadow of folly is that it can lead to great acts of genocide. Collective folly, therefore, was a contrast to collective wisdom, that groups can lead themselves into great acts of horror, the genocides, the Holocaust, all the different ways, small and large, we know folly. But we were saying something very specific, that folly is a byproduct of fragmentation and separation, that the greater the fragmentation of one's own thought and the fragmentation of each other's thoughts, the greater the chance for folly to arise in the group, the greater chance for tragic consequences of that fragmentation. So we all have the experience of being with a group and everyone says what they want to say and no one's listening, no one's talking with each other, they're talking to each other or down to each other. And it is at those moments when the group is most vulnerable for folly, because there is anxiety building, there's a potential for rash judgments, and so that separation begins to show up first in the person, the individual, and then in the group itself. Folly is not simply that people make a bad decision. Folly is two movements, one toward polarization, in which two individuals or two groups begin to be more interested in what makes them different from each other than in what can be done together.
Mm-hmm. So instead of collectively coming together as one, they're actually kind of polarizing themselves, correct?
They polarize. Now, every group must deal with differences, and we'll get to this in a minute. But it is when those differences, instead of moving us toward a more transcendent understanding of our situation, move us into camps, move us into personal disputes or subgroup disputes. Obviously, we have that at a political level, but we also have it in virtually every organizational level as well. The second movement of collective folly, polarization being the first, is toward false agreement. So it's very useful to remind ourselves, when everyone is shaking their head and saying yes, that could very well be a signal that the group is in danger of a foolish decision. Because they may not have explored the divergence, they may not have sought to find what other ideas were represented other than those people agreeing with each other. So collective folly became a way of seeing the signals, either through polarization that becomes that moves us toward dehumanizing each other, or toward false agreement that doesn't allow us to explore divergent thinking.
Interesting. Well, you know, one of the things that you discuss in this book for getting to more deep listening within these groups is a mindfulness practice. Can you speak to our listening audience about the mindfulness practice for really creating safe space for inquiry? I think that's an important thing. I think that many people, if they were to look at that, there might be more successes in the deep collective body if they were more mindful in their preparation before entering these groups?
Well, there's two parts to this. One is the importance of design, or what some are calling social architecture. We need, just as we would create a home so that there is places where people can gather, where people can feel a comfortable being in relation to others, so too in organizations we need to think about what designs are needed so people can express their true thinking, people can work with differences without it becoming polarized to the point of dysfunctionality. And so there's a strong thread throughout the book about the importance of designing our settings that allow for safety. And safety here means the safety give expression to one's authentic self and true feelings. I would distinguish that from saying that we give people a chance to complain for a few minutes and then tell them what they have to do that there became, I think, a distortion in organizations that somehow you could get buy-in is if you let people complain for a little bit and then, you know, they'll feel better and do what you want them to. That alternative to that is we need to really have ways that we can understand each other, understand what our aspirations are, understand our fears, and then directly work toward resolving or transcending or mitigating those concerns. Hmm. That's the design work. The mindfulness work is always being alert to one's own thinking. I've never met someone who won't acknowledge that they're in a group and they have an immediate reaction to someone else, often unfavorable. You know, they don't like the way they look, they don't like the way they sound, they disagree with their viewpoint. And it's at those moments that mindfulness is critical, that we don't just react to them or try to respond to them in the same way we feel they've responded to us, but that we are aware that something has entered our social field that's disruptive, that's dissident, and now what is the choices we make about working with that person and that information. So mindfulness is a way of saying connected to one's own energy, to one's own experience, and neither denying it or affirming it, meaning that we hold it lightly. We recognize the reactions that are happening, and that the more we do that, the more we create the emotional space to work with those reactions.
Now, you mentioned that throughout this, that this co-creative potential exists whenever human beings gather together in groups like this. Can you cite some examples, because you give quite a few in the books, of individuals that utilize this co-creative power to actually shift, I wouldn't say the world per se, but to shift certain perspectives?
Well, there was both very personal examples and historical examples. What you're giving voice to, I think, Greg, is that each time we gather with people, we can experience ourselves in an I-Thou relationship to them. Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who was, you know, one of the real mentors to us during the development of this book, talked about the I-Thou relationship as two people always being aware that they're in the presence of the divine. And so when we approach people in this way, the very act of how we listen to them, the way we respond, the way we show curiosity, begins to deepen the social field that we're creating with them. And those acts of collaboration have just extraordinary energy to them. You know, if you want to look anything from the Obama candidacy of how it created these connected social fields in which people all felt they had something to contribute, they all felt that there was something worth working together on. And at times what had to be done is they had to be reminded not to simply do what they did because they hated something, but because there's things we could better do together if we stayed focused on what was worth doing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's such a great example, the Obama campaign and the collective wisdom and power, as you call it, that came together. Now, where would our listeners go to find more information about this websites? I know you've got them listed in the back of the book, but also to obtain a copy of the book. And any information they might have, you might have out there, about actually forming groups and keeping groups together sustainably?
Well, the first part of your question is the best place to go would be our website, thepowerofcollectivewisdom.com. One word, thepowerofcollectivewisdom.com. People can also visit my website, which is www.alanbriskin, also one word, A-L-A-N-B-R-I-S-K-I-N, alanbriskin.com. And you can purchase the book from either of those websites. The question of groups coming together is, one is, from the very beginning, 10 years ago, we began to see this occurring spontaneously, whether people do it in book clubs, whether they do it to organize to help with issues in their community. But the best place to point readers would be in that second chapter we mentioned, the six commitments that help create the ground for collective wisdom to arise. I'm working with a group now that's wanting to put that into more of a handout format and call it six things that will advance the outcomes of your groups together. And it's the things that we talked about a bit earlier, deep listening, the ability to suspend personal certainty, the ability to look for diverse perspectives, that invitation for people to discern distinctions that are is within the group in order to come up with a larger, stronger whole.
Yeah, I think it's so valuable. And, you know, just like the World Cafe, somebody's going to put this together and post it at your website for people to download, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're developing different formats and tools all the time, so it's worth signing up to the website and being kept informed of what's going to be developing there.
Beautiful. Well, you know, the work that you and the other co-authors have done here is so needed. I just want to let my listeners know, if you are interested at all in coming together in a collective body and understanding the power of this and the power of the co-creative process, I would certainly recommend reading Alan's book. It's called The Power of Collective Wisdom and the Trap of Collective Folly. It's been out a couple of months. It's by Barrett Kohler Publications. And as Alan had mentioned, mention your website one more time for our listeners so they can get it, especially the one that goes to the book itself.
It's www.thepowerofcollectivewisdom.com.
Powerofcollectivewisdom.com. It's been a pleasure having you on the show today. I know we could probably speak for a lot longer. The reality is we'll have to invite you back again to take a deeper look at some of the things in here. But it certainly is at least a good introduction to the folks, and I want to encourage them to go out and get the book. It will provide them with the necessary tools and insights they need and to what is pretty much required to have a good, powerful collective body and wisdom of people coming together to do good things for the world. So, Alan, your work is always appreciated, you and your fellow authors here, in actually helping to transform the world. I just want to thank you and acknowledge you guys for the good work that you do.
Greg, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Great. And we'll talk again soon.